too much cold. Too much cold, see...
His name is Arthur Aholt. I might also add that recently we had the pleasure of talking with his brother, Major Aholt from Washington, D.C. My other guests this morning are Dominic Lucchesi. And I understand that Dominic will be with us on Friday night, which will be our Saturday morning show. And I think he'll be here with Augie Roberts and one or two other people. And we're going to get some additional information about the Darrows. And although you may not buy the Darrow story, I don't. However, I understand that there's some new information that may be at least interesting to listen to and may possibly change some of our opinions about the Darrows. And of course, if you know nothing about the Darrows, let me briefly recap. We have been told that this is a group of people that live in the center of the earth. You say that's unusual? If that's all you can say about it, then you're not listening. I think it's the weirdest thing I've ever heard. Now, the Darrows, it is said, come out from time to time. They have tremendous machinery that is under the earth. In fact, we have been told, when I say we, it has been alleged by people on this program, that in three communities in this country, namely New York City, Chicago, Illinois, and Providence, Rhode Island, and I might add that recently I heard from somebody that the same situation exists in Los Angeles. Whether this is true or not, I don't know. And whether I say whether this is true or not, I don't mean to imply that the first three named cities that I have proof that this phenomena exists. Providence, Rhode Island, Chicago, and New York. Basically, it is rumored that there is an apartment house building in each one of these communities. An ordinary apartment house building certainly appears to be ordinary to the occupants, the tenants in that building, and to the people that visit the tenants, and to the tradesmen that do business with the tenants in these three buildings. But there is something rather unusual about it that the tenants are not aware of, we have been told. In these three apartment house buildings, one in Providence, Rhode Island, one in New York, and one in Chicago, Illinois, they have automatic elevators. I've been told that the one in Providence has three elevators. The one in New York has one, and the one in Chicago has one. They're all automatic elevators. Now, when you get in that elevator and you press the button, 6th floor, 5th, 8th, 7th, whatever you want, it functions the same as any ordinary automatic elevator. There are two doors, an inside door, which is a protection door. That is the door that rides with the cab. And the other door is the door that is on the floor, which separates the floor from the entrance to the shaft. Now, here's what's unusual about these automatic elevators, or at least it is alleged to be very unusual. When you get in to any one of these five elevators, three in Providence, one in New York, and one in Chicago, when you get in and you press the button marked B, basement, you go down to the basement. Certainly nothing unusual about this. This happens every day in millions of automatic elevators. And naturally, the door of the cab opens, and then the door to the basement opens. And after a few minutes, if somebody on any one of the other floors pushed the button, automatically the two doors would close, and once again you'd go to the other floor. But when you are at the basement level of any one of those buildings, if you press that B button again, both doors automatically closed, the cab door and the door of the basement. And the cab continues to go down, down, and down into the land of the Darrows. This is what I've been told. It's difficult for me to believe. In other words, the base of these elevator shafts, it has been told that they open up. Now, of course, if you're in there with two or three people, nothing happens. You press the button marked D when you're at the basement level, nothing happens. You press M, which is main floor again, both doors close, and the cab returns to the main floor, to the lobby floor. There's only one variation, I have been told, and that is in the three elevators that are in the one apartment house building in Providence. As I say again, this is what we have been told. One of the elevators, when you do arrive at the basement level, and you press the button marked B the second time, the shaft of this particular elevator does not open. Instead, the elevator goes to the left of the shaft and then continues down in another shaft that is not visible to anybody, we have been told. This story, I don't know whether to call it a story or what it may be, but actually it was brought about by a man by the name of Richard Shaver, and a gentleman who was editor of a science fiction publication, Ray Palmer. We are told it is not science fiction. We are told that it's based on fact. I do not know. We'll learn more about that Friday night, our Saturday morning show. My other guest this morning, James W. Mosley. Mr. Mosley is editor of Saucer News. And I happen to have the new edition in front of me, the dated April, May, 1958. We'll be talking about some of the articles in Saucer News. And I know so many people write and they say, I'd like to get in touch with Mosley about Saucer News. I can only say this. His post office box is number 163, Fort Lee, New Jersey. Post office box 163, Fort Lee, New Jersey. Bill Kent is with us this morning. Bill Kent is a publicist, Sergeant Morris Paley of the Perth Amboy Police Department. My name is Long John. We call it the party line. We're around for 5.5 hours, 37.5 during the given week. Before we get talking with our guests of the morning, let me take a moment to talk about one of our sponsors. I certainly want to welcome you back, Arthur Aho. Unfortunately, the last time it was just 2 minutes on the air. And if you're real good, tonight we may permit you to stay for 3 minutes.
Well, I'm very...
You're through already.
Well,
all right, continue a little while longer.
No, not that short. After the Darrows get about a half an hour, surely I ought to get as much as the Darrows, because, after all, he's talking about more fantastic things than flying saucers. I think we ought to get in at least the rest of the program on flying saucers on that basis. I had quite a trip out here. I stopped across the country. I drove this time instead of flying because, well, I have quite a few places to stop and the winter weather isn't too good, so I compared notes with quite a number of people coming across country, and I found where a lot of people had seen flying saucers and talked about them, but they're beginning to accept those pretty well by this time, it seems like, in the field. But the interesting thing that I found was the interest that is, you might say, in the atmosphere of research labs and so on, is in what makes them fly. And there's quite a move to determine, or you might say, research into the basics in electronics as a result of flying saucers. And that's quite intriguing. I've done quite a bit of research in that, and I find it very fascinating, and some of the ends seem to be tying together.
If I may interrupt for a moment, Arthur, you say that you've been doing research.
Yes, not too much with actually laboratory research, yes. especially with the basic ideas involved behind it. I have done some, and I plan to do some more.
But this is in the line of flying saucers.
It started with flying saucers, and when you observe these craft flying in the air, why, you say, well, something is behind this. They're flying on something, and they don't come down for fuel, so you say, well, how do they fly? And then you observe a rather peculiar motion along with the saucers. You see a definite pulsing motion, especially in the light emanations from the ships themselves, and also they seem to bob up and down when you observe them from the side. So it's a very definite pattern that seems to fall in line, and it gives somewhat of a clue for basic research in a way from that.
Mm-hmm. Arthur, I'm interested in your description of these saucers. I am led to believe by your recent statement that you evidently have seen a tremendous amount of saucers, certainly, or UFOs. Certainly just seeing one bobbing up and down would not be an adequate amount to continue your research in this direction.
Well, I have seen quite a few. In one place in California, there's a fault line that runs up close to San Francisco, and it runs alongside the hill. Or it goes
I'm
in
behind. Sorry, I didn't get that term, sir. What line?
It's a fault line in the earth. It's the fault line of earthquake line is where the earthquakes occur in California.
I've never heard the term before. I'm sorry, sir.
It's a fault line. And this runs behind the Stanford University along the hill there. And on several occasions, I've observed strange goings-on around that, as if something or other was keeping tabs on it or surveying or something. And you notice lights, for instance, those on this special type of observation, you see lights against this hillside that are pulsating, and they go down to a fine pinpoint, and then they come to a bigger one, looks like a moon or something, and you say, well, there's some kind of a car there, maybe, and finally, when one of them raises up above the ridge, you say, well, a car couldn't very well do that, so you watch it, and you don't seem to know exactly what it is, but I have a friend that lives there alongside this hill, and he and his wife had called our attention to this, what they call phenomena going on around there, and they had one experience that was rather interesting, and in fact, they followed a saucer that came in close to their house. They got in their car, and they followed this craft for approximately 2 hours. It was meandering around the area and going up one road and up a canyon or a draw and then back out again, and finally it went up a draw and stopped, and they drove their car within about, oh, they say around 75 feet of it, and it was not on the ground. It was hovering above the ground, and they got out of the car and got, oh, within about 45 feet of it, and this man works in an electronics plant, and he said he had a feeling very similar to being alongside of a big generator. He said his hair seemed to want to stand on end, and he felt a tingling sensation.
How close was he to this?
About 40 or 45 feet, he said. He and his wife both, and
Did she have this same sensation of her hair?
Yes, she claimed
to be attracted.
And they stayed alongside of it, they claimed, for about 15 minutes, and observed it, and nothing happened, so they thought, well, maybe they'd better get out of this, so they got in their car and went back home. But they have observed the same type of going on as I observed there, oh, perhaps two or three nights a week. And I have watched that, and then I have seen some from the airplane.
I wonder if I may just interrupt again, Arthur. Recently, there was a telecast, I think it was January 22nd, if I'm not mistaken, on the Armstrong Circle Theater, and on that particular evening, at least the telecast was seen in this section of the country at 10 o'clock at night, and Major Donald Kehoe was on it, a representative of the Air Force, and the man who I'd like to talk to you about for a moment was a Dr. Menzel of Harvard University. When he was interviewed by Doug Edwards, he made this statement, and I think I'm almost quoting him. He said, "It's a lot of hot air," and he meant it two ways.
Yes, I'm quite well aware of his reports. In fact, he's quoted the most because of his negative attitude, so...
You mean to be able to be quoted a lot, you have to have a negative attitude?
Well, it depends on who's quoting.
I see. Uh-huh.
If the negative quote is desired, why, Dr. Menzel is definitely called on. I have seen his reports in many places in that same manner.
I gather that you don't go along with Dr. Menzel.
Well, no, because after all, I'd be I'd probably have lost a few marbles, too, because I've seen some things also, and I feel that I'm a qualified observer. I live alongside of an airport. In fact, I keep my airplane in my backyard, and the airplanes to Oakland Airport and San Francisco Airport go directly over my house, and jets fly over there. I have seen aircraft by the thousands, I can identify them quite easily. And when you see something that is very, very different from that, you have to say, well, you saw something, so I would definitely not agree with Dr. Menzel.
Well, Arthur, I don't think that Dr. Menzel has ever made the statement that you haven't seen anything. He's seen a lot of things, too. And now you've just mentioned, and I'm aware of this, too, that you happen to be a pilot. You're a member of Aircraft Owners and Pilots Association, and you're very familiar with air travel. But are you an astronomer?
Well... I wouldn't say that I'm an astronomer other than studying the works of astronomers. I have done that.
Mm-hmm.
After all, we do not have telescopes available to us to observe for ourselves, so we have to naturally take the reports of observers that have telescopes and read of their works. So,
and you feel that the observers that you have, that you've read their reports, that their telescopes would be comparable to the telescopes that would be made available to Dr. Menzel?
Well, I don't know what kind of telescopes he uses, but did you read a report which was published by Ruppelt, Captain Ruppelt?
In his book or a recent report?
It was in his book.
Mm-hmm.
And he stated that he called a group of astronomers together and that they asked this group about life on other planets. That was it possible, in their opinion, for life to live on other or exist on other planets in a similar form as ours? And he stated that 65% of the astronomers, he didn't say how many there were. There could have been 10, there could have been 30, but he said 65% of this group stated that positively there could be millions of planets that could support life in a very similar, of a similar type as ours, and also that 30% of the astronomers gathered refused to comment, and only 3% said no. So Dr. Menzel has opposition also.
Mm-hmm. Well, my question is just based on this. It's merely... During a conversation of this type, Arthur, we do ask a number of questions. And as I say, I am not trying to underestimate your ability or knowledge, but I feel rather confident in stating that I don't think that you're as qualified as an astronomer as Menzel would be. And when you tell me that you have reports from observers, I would assume that you're talking about amateur astronomers. Is that true?
No, I have read the works of astronomers through a period of time, and in fact I read the recent publications that are put out by, you might say, National Observation of Astronomers. It's their regular astronomy magazines, and I have read books on astronomy from quite a few years on back. I have followed it in order to get a little better understanding of what the universe that we live in looks like and what its relation is also to other galaxies.
Well, I really can't discuss that with you too much. I'm not too familiar with it. One thing I'm very familiar with, though, Arthur, and that is that this is WOR Radio, your station in New York, and it's 710 on the dial.
Yes, John, I'd like to disagree with you for one moment. And that is...
In other words, this is your last night on the show. No, don't turn his mic off yet. No, go ahead, Bill.
Well, you mentioned about Dr. Menzel saying that the sources were a lot of hot air, and you also compared Mr. Aho's telescope in a derogatory way with Dr. Menzel's telescope.
I didn't even know that Arthur Aho had a telescope.
I do not have a telescope.
But you said, we had the Amateur Astronomers Association here one night, and if I can judge by them, they said that they have telescopes up all the time, looking, and if they see any flying saucers, they won't believe it. And in the first place, they're not looking for flying saucers. They won't believe what they see if they see it. So therefore, if astronomers, and just judging by this one group, don't look for flying saucers, don't believe what they see if they see it, and if they consider it, and if Dr. Menzel, for instance, considers it hot air, therefore he's not going to look for any.
Of course, you know that Dr. Menzel, as I mentioned, in all fairness to him, he meant that in two ways. It's bunk, but also the hot air. There's some phenomenon or phenomena that occurs that could create an illusion of flying saucers. He meant it in two ways. No, I mean that sincerely. I think you've made an excellent point, though, Bill. I remember we did have the pleasure of talking with a group from the Amateur Astronomers Association of the City of New York. I think the gentleman's name, the president, was a Mr. Fry. Am I correct?
Right.
Mr. Fry. Of course, although Mr. Fry was possibly representing the Amateur Astronomers Association, it was quite obvious that he was representing them because he seemed to walk out prior to the end of the program because he felt that we were asking questions about flying saucers and they didn't want to answer those type of questions. But he made it very emphatic that members of the association, as a group, are not interested in flying saucers. And if they have any interest in flying saucers, I presume that this is done with a smoke glass telescope, so that no one else knows what they're doing. That's the only thing I can say about it. But it's an interesting point, and possibly I should be criticized, because if an association like the Amateur Astronomers Association will not even admit that they may see something that is unusual, something that they cannot explain, they would not rather not even admit that they've seen it.
Right.
So I think you've made a point for Arthur Aho. Jim Mosley?
Well, John, I had a point that I wanted to bring out to Art. I've talked to a number of people who have seen flying saucers, but usually any one person has not made more than one sighting. I wanted to ask him how many sightings he has made altogether up until this date.
Well, I have seen quite a few doubtfuls, but what I would call good sightings that I would say definitely were not aircraft, numbers about five, numbers five. Well, I could say six or seven, perhaps, but five very good ones. And the last one was in New Jersey. That was last Wednesday. I stopped there and visited with some very fine people for a while and found that they had seen a number of them over there, too. And I saw what I considered a very good sighting because it appeared to be only about 1,000 to 1,500 feet in altitude and approximately 2 miles distance, and there were four of us observing it. And I had my field glasses, and I observed it with the field glasses and saw a very strange thing along with observing it just without glasses.
Would you care to tell us something about this strange thing that you saw? And I might also ask one other question first. We certainly don't want to know the names of the people that you were visiting in New Jersey unless you care to mention it. But could you tell us the town that it was, or the county?
Yes, it was in Pennsylvania. Now, I'm not too familiar with Pennsylvania.
Yes. You mean
near the line of New Jersey,
mm-hmm.
Yes. And the thing that I saw, we were observing an area where several saucers had been seen by these people quite recently. So I was on the right-hand side of the car, and one of the boys there said, "You keep an eye on that side." So I was doing just that, and about that time I saw a large red ball coming from the back of the car, and approximately 2 miles distance and traveling approximately 400 miles an hour, as close as I could estimate, if it was 2 miles distance. And I took the field glasses immediately, and when I put the field glasses up, I realized it was not a red ball at all. It was a triangle. That was not a perfect triangle of three red balls of smaller size. One was larger, and another one about middle size, and one smaller. And then from one ball to the other was a funny-looking red glow running in a circle from this ball to ball, and from point to point in this triangle. And the light was pulsating. You didn't notice it so much, the pulsation with the field glasses themselves, but when you observed it with the naked eye, you could see at each time this saucer seemed to kind of dip, although I called it a saucer, but this red object seemed to dip. It dimmed a little. And then when it raised up, it brightened again, then dimmed a little, and it went for a distance of about 10 miles with this odd loping gait. And this, when you'd observe it through the glasses, three of us looked at it through the glasses, and all of them saw the same thing of this fire or appearance of fire or effect. It looked more like electronic effect running around in a circle in the triangle, and the center was quite dark.
Well, Jim, I'd just like to ask this before we go on. If the average person feels that he's very fortunate if he's seen one saucer, how do you explain the fact that you've been fortunate enough to see five different sightings which you feel are definite? Do you feel this because you're a pilot, or that you've been more interested, or you've been watching? I mean, what would you actually feel is the reason that you've been so blessed, shall we say, with this number of sightings?
That is quite a question, Arthur, and I believe we're all interested in that. I know that usually they have a single sighting, and here you came up with five positives and two doubtfuls. How do you explain it?
Well, I'll put it in this way, that I did not have any luck whatsoever for about a year and a half, at least, after
I
started looking.
You mean a sighting is luck?
Well, you can consider it that, perhaps.
Well,
I thought
you have to search the heavens for these things.
Well, you have to be at the right place, apparently, at the right time, and looking in the right direction, so you have three already against you, and doing a lot of flying and doing a lot of outdoor living, I did have more opportunity, perhaps, than the average individual.
Dominic?
Well, Art, I got a few questions I'd like to ask you. Approximately 20 minutes ago, you made the statement that you were doing research in basic electronics. Could you explain what you mean by basic electronics?
Well, in a way, I'll put it in this manner, that ordinarily, science is looking from the point of what we observe and taking things apart in order to try to determine what the effect might be, or try to determine what it is, or what the result of experiments are. And we went into atomics in that same manner. And 7 years ago, for instance, it was pretty well decided that an atom, for instance, was only three particles. Well, sadly enough, it didn't turn out that way. In a recent movie put out by Bell Telephone, they showed that they have found additional particles now that went up to 24, and then it kept on increasing. It is increasing more rapidly, so they state that where we had the thing all wrapped up 7 years ago, why, now we have nothing. It's all blown up. So we have to then assume, which is also a report that was put out by several thousand scientists gathered together. There were 2,000 made the report on a national convention, and the summary of this was that perhaps it was more advisable to try to find the answer of the cause of all matter, you might say, in observing the effects of experiments and trying to evaluate from that and arrive at what the cause might be, because they have taken things apart to the point that you get to smaller and smaller particles, and it's merely adding confusion. So in the research that, well, you can't really call it electronics. You have to call it basically the whole of everything, that there is a cause for material in the first place. So my attempt has been to evaluate from experiments done by myself and also experiments that have been done in labs, and they have written their experiments down into books. And I study these experiments and attempt to put from information gathered from many, many sources, including astronomy, and also I would take in information as given by contacts on flying saucers, and try to put together a picture that would hold together in, you might say, relation to experiments done. And I dare say I have found some very interesting things.
Arthur, when you opened up your discussion, you made a few statements, and I'd like to question a few of them. The first thing I'd like to comment on is the fact that you said there was a fault line in the West area, and it ran in back of Stanford U, and you've seen quite a number of queer things there. But then, isn't that predominant throughout the United States? Wherever there's a university, you see strange and odd things because of the students there. Isn't that a strong possibility of a hoax of some of the students? Because we know for a fact that quite a number of the college boys will pull a stunt or two. Isn't that a possibility?
Yes, but then I mentioned Stanford University to get the location. Stanford University is in Palo Alto, and this place where I observed these and where they have been
seen... Well, if I may interrupt, the reason I ask that question is that immediately after saying Stanford U, you said quite a few queer things have happened in that area. And it just hit me immediately that you always have pranksters at a university.
Yes, I noticed that happened in the University of California here quite recently. But I'll carry this fault line farther. It starts, or one branch of it, or an ending of it, you might say, is in Crescent City, California, and or in the hills from there. And there is a Major Moore lives up there, and he has reported that over a period of 2 years, ending last year, he had seen any number of strange things at his place. He's a personal friend of mine. I used to know him years ago, and I have met him since.
That's very interesting, Arthur. Now, I just want to get this picture in my mind. Now, this fault line is the earthquake zone.
That is correct.
And the earthquake zone is usually in a warm climate.
No, there are earthquake zones all over the U.S.
But this particular earthquake zone that we're talking about right now, this fault line that we're talking about right now, isn't that in a warm climate?
Well, it extends the entire length of California.
Yes, and isn't it warm there?
Well, Crescent City is about similar to this.
What I'm driving at is this.
In
a warm belt, don't you have the simmering heat waves?
Well, no, you would not in the northern part of California.
But in the southern part and the central part, you would?
Well, you could, yes, but...
Isn't giant rock in the warmer part?
Yes, but...
And isn't that where most of the sightings are being seen?
No.
Isn't that near the desert where we see an awful lot of mirages?
No, I wouldn't agree with that at all, because...
Well, you mean there are no mirages in the desert?
No, I have observed things in the desert myself that could be mistaken for flying saucers.
Right.
But a giant rock, regardless of how much time I spent there, which ran into several months, I did not have a good sighting in the desert at any time.
Mm-hmm.
So, but Adamski claims that living on the end of the fault zone where he lives, he has observed strange things in the area directly in connection, perhaps, with the fault zone. And you follow this same fault zone up, and there has been apparently more sightings along this zone than any other.
Well, talking about giant rock, I saw in the newspapers recently, I think it was a Detroit paper, that your brother made a very excellent sighting out of giant rock in 1956. I think it must have been during the saucer convention. This article that I saw said that he got within 125 feet of the saucer and saw it land and take off a number of times. Do you know any details about that?
Well, other than what he told me himself. I was there at the time. It was during the convention, but I, like most people, was sleeping at the time, so whatever he saw, we didn't get in on it. He was out walking around, and so whatever he saw, why, he saw it.
Well, you were there at the same time as he was, but you didn't see the same thing that he saw?
No, because I was sleeping, and I don't see much with my eyes shut, so I didn't see that.
Well, that isn't a strange phenomenon. Bill Kemp.
Well, you started out your questioning, Sergeant, by talking about earthquakes, and an earthquake is caused... an earthquake has nothing to do with the temperature, the climate, by the way. It's caused by... It occurs in new areas, that is, where there is... Eruptions are caused by pressures of gases and lava and other things, which break the surface through the great pressures. And
May I interrupt to question?
Yeah.
Isn't there heat where there's lava?
Yes.
That's all.
But you're talking about the temperature of the area in terms of the zone, climatic zone.
No, I'm sorry I gave that impression, Bill. I meant where there are earthquakes and where there is an eruption, there is heat due to combustion. And wherever there's heat, there's a simmering of the airwaves.
There is heat only at the point of the earthquake and surrounding area. Once the quake has occurred, and I don't know that there's been a major quake for a few years on the West Coast, the area isn't warm. The land isn't warm. Only at the point of the earthquake, if there's still eruptions or around the area. The land isn't any warmer between earthquakes where an earthquake might occur every 4 or 5 years.
But the majority of these sightings were from Central California south. In the warmer section,
were they?
I would like to point this one out. Crescent City, California is right on the Oregon border, approximately, I'd say around 25 miles south of the Oregon border. And this place of Major Moore's is approximately 25 miles inland. And this was rather interesting because I took some pictures of flying saucers that had been taken in various parts of the country, and I showed them to Major Moore at his request because I had written him after I had moved away from the area and asked him if any of these craft had landed because other people had been at his place and observed these along with him. And he told me that none of them had landed. But when I was in Crescent City, why, I should contact him and we'd talk it over. So I showed him some pictures taken in various parts of the country, and he took some. He took Adamski's picture and one taken by Howard Menger, and he says, yep, he says, that's it. He says, that looks just like the craft that came over my house and hovered there about 50-foot altitude and stayed there for some time. He says, no one came out, but... He says that was it, without a doubt. And he says he has observed the same craft through field glasses. He lives in a small valley, and his house is in the middle of this valley, like. And in different sides of this valley, it seemed like these craft would hover along this hillside. He claimed one that was rather odd. I had never heard of that one before, but... He said one of them lowered a basket out of it. He said it looked like they lowered a gondola out of the bottom of the thing, and it came on the end of the rope, and it looked like there was somebody in it. He says he was watching it through the field glasses, and he couldn't make out what they were doing. He says finally they pulled a gondola up again, and away they went. I hadn't heard of that one before, so you hear some strange ones. But he has not made his sightings known in any way other than to talk about it in the area, but... He's a major also. He's retired. He has quite a
Dominic?
Bit of experience behind him.
Well, we're back to the basic research in electronics again. We went from basic research into electronics into more or less what appears to me the field of nuclear physics. And now that we're in basic nuclear physics, which is very simple actually, because basic doesn't mean rudimentary or simple. So now we're in a simple field of nuclear physics. I'd like to ask, how does this relate to the light? In other words, you said there was a light relationship there before. What is the basic relation between basic research in electronics, which later turns into nuclear physics, and then turns into some form of light relationship?
Well, light could perhaps better be stated in that term, if we're going to discuss it in that manner, the next step above what you would call particles, as we know particles. You would call it a frequency of vibration. But this is an interesting point to bring out in there, as It is related to it. In a recent science newsletter published in Washington, D.C., it's a weekly newsletter, they had a picture of an experiment done in Stevens Institute of Technology here in the city. And I plan to go there and pick up the originals, and it might be interesting for you boys to do some of the same. They had a picture of a galaxy, they said, or a model of a galaxy, which they made by bombarding hunks of ionized particles at each other under certain conditions. I'm not too sure whether this was done in a cloud chamber or otherwise, but they stated in the caption that the Creator made generators billions of years before man, as this thing that they made with this experiment turned out to be a model of a galaxy with pinwheels, but also a force field similar to a generator around the pinwheels. So it had also a field as well as the pinwheel itself. And that by the same term, they stated that a solar system then would be a miniature generator within a galaxy generator, and by the same term that a planet would then be a smaller generator within the solar system. So we're tying actually electronic fields together.
Excuse me, Mr. Rahel, this is WOR 710 on your dial.
Arthur, I'd like to ask you another question in relation to that particular phase of your previous comment, and that was that you made the comment then. In other words, what you're saying is that this basic research in electronics, which leads to basic research in nuclear physics, leads into a light relationship, which is a form of turning light radiation into a direct corpuscular particle of matter. Is that correct?
Yes, that would be a good summary of it. Very good.
Now, we went into telescopes right after that. And actually, I don't think that equipment is necessary for... I don't know too much about astronomy myself, but many of our more famous observations have been made on what we may term inferior equipment, that is, inferior to professional equipment. Galileo had a very poor telescope, and he did excellent work with it. Nicholas Copernicus, I don't think his telescope was much better than Galileo's. And in fact, most of our comets were discovered by the amateur telescope observer. So I don't think actually the quality of the object or the scope actually has anything to do with what is seen through it. I think it's a matter of individual observation and tenacity to in order to achieve a sighting. Now, you made a statement there that these objects you saw, which were tied together by these weird forms of wave emanations, were not aircraft. What would you say they were?
Well, I would have to say they were aircraft, all right, because they were flying in the air, but they were not a conventional type of aircraft as we know.
Oh, that's what I see. I just wanted to clarify that point, Mr. Rahel. Would you answer me one question, Art?
Yes, be happy.
What is a flying saucer?
Well, in my opinion, a flying saucer is an aircraft from some other planet, and I can't put it any other way because I've, in what I have followed in this, I firmly believe that that is exactly what it is.
Could you tell me how you arrived at the opinion that these circular air forms are from another planet?
Well, in traveling around for 3 years and talking with people who claim to have had experiences with these craft, and many of these people have not written books on the subject, they have merely stated their experiences, and many of them have had witnesses. And when they speak of people coming from these craft and they state that they are from some other planet, well, you more or less have to, after you see many, many of these incidents brought out, that perhaps it must be so. You finally become convinced that there is something behind it. But I have one incident, for instance, that convinced me from the standpoint of newspaper men, for instance. I have a very good friend in Oakland. He's on a radio station there, and he has a file on flying saucers.
Is that the all-night man there?
No.
You know who I'm thinking of.
Yes, it is not. It's a daytime reporter, and I could mention your name, but perhaps I shouldn't at the time.
You're welcome to. I mean, you'd rather not to.
John, well, no, I will not, because the thing that I am going to relate is he gave me in confidence.
Well, now, I'll tell you, I noticed that you're going into your briefcase there to get out some notes. While you're looking for those notes, let me take a moment to talk about one of our sponsors, so you can tell us about the facts that he has.
Yes, I would like to use his name only. Some of this information was given him in confidence, so I cannot use it
out
of respect. But he states that he has a very good friend who has been in the newspaper business for years and years, and he has known him for a long period of time. And that this friend relates a story going back to about 1950 of an incident that occurred in Virginia. He states that this friend was one of several newspaper men who were asked to be at a certain remote area or location in Virginia, along with some military men and also with some government men from the administrative branch of government, and that they made their appearance as requested, and a flying saucer landed, and people got out of the flying saucer, got out, shook hands with them, demonstrated their craft, and then went on about their business. But this was, according to him, several newspaper men in this contact. I've heard several stories very similar to that. And, of course, it's all hearsay because so much of this saucer is hearsay. But I do know a lot of people who have not published books who claim to have had very big experiences with saucers.
You say you know a lot of people who claim that they have had unusual experiences with saucers.
Yes.
You know, if I may take a moment, Arthur, to talk to you. You know, we had the pleasure, or at least I had the pleasure, I'm not going to say it was mutual, you'll have to determine that yourself. I had the pleasure meeting you again when we were out at the convention, the 4th Annual Interplanetary Spacecraft Convention, that was May 11th and May 12th. And no doubt you remember that I talked to, I can say on tape, to at least 80 to 90 people out there. Now, when I say people, I'm not including the twins, the Sanford twins. I'm not including Fry or any of the people that I interviewed. I'm talking about the people that were walking around, milling around, that I would have them walk up to the mic and talk to them for a moment. I was quite amazed that of all the people that I talked to, maybe 80 or 90, and I might add that I think I talked to at least 50 or 60 other than that, because my equipment was not working for a period of time, so I couldn't record their conversations. And of all the people that I talked to, and all of those people were interested in flying saucers, not one of them had an experience of being in a saucer, meeting the people. The only experiences they had was that they saw something that appeared to be unusual in the sky. Now, of course, I'll say this, that I spoke to two or three people who are known in the field as being contactees of the Venusians or the Martians, and that was Fry, the Sanford twins, and one or two other people. But those were regular interviews that I'd planned to get. Now, why is it that when we have some 8,000 or 10,000 people on there on a Saturday and a Sunday, people who are honestly believers in this phenomenon, why is it that more of them have not had the actual physical contact? Do you have any answer to that, Arthur A. Hull?
No, I don't believe I have. I'm not qualified to answer that because this seems to be a certain type of a thing, and I don't know exactly why it is that way, but that's the way it seems to be. They're seen more at a distance than at close range, and there are not too many people that have made contacts that you run into, although there are quite a few that claim that. But actual contacts, whether there have been more made, and these people do not state it, or whether there have been only a certain number made, that will have to remain for perhaps later questioning or
looking into. Well, that gives me one more question, and then I know that Jim Mosley is anxious to get in there. Jim is so anxious that I think he'd even buy commercial time to be able to get a question. Why is it, first of all, let me make a statement. It's a statement on my part. It's a belief that I have. After talking with a number of people who claim that they've had contacts with Venusians and Martians, they all tell me that the Martians and the Venusians are on this planet to bring us a message. We'll accept that for just a moment. And in accepting that, my next question would naturally be, if Martians or Venusians select, we'll say, a Dominic Lucchesi or a Bill Kent or a Mrs. Doe, why is it that Mr. Lucchesi, why is it that a Mr. Kent, why is it that a Mrs. Doe does not tell her story? Because that is the reason why the Martians and the Venusians want to contact these people, so that they'll spread, and I'll put this word in quotes, the gospel around.
Well, there are several people that definitely do not want to face the ridicule that they would run into if they made their statement, and there perhaps are others who would maybe lose their position in present-day business or what you have.
Don't the Venusians or Martians know this prior to the time that they contact this person who may lose his position?
Well, perhaps so. Perhaps that is why such people who do not have much to lose are contacted. Maybe they're the only ones who will go ahead and spread the message.
That, you know, you're not answering my question, Arthur. The question is, you have mentioned, you made a statement that there are many people that have had contacts and they're afraid to say it.
Yeah.
And now you tell me that the reason that the people who are getting the contacts are because they have not much to lose. On the other hand, you say the reason they don't mention it because the people have too much to lose. Now, what is it, Arthur?
Well, if they didn't have much to lose in material wealth, well, perhaps they could have something to lose in, well, you might call, through ridicule and so on. I do not know how people react. I know that if I made a contact of that type, I wouldn't be afraid to talk about it, but I can't answer for the other guy because I don't know how he feels.
Mm-hmm. Jim Mosley.
Well, I'd like to ask Arthur this. Now, you mentioned before that you've made 5 sightings that you feel are definitely of spacecraft, and you also stated that you feel that these sightings were only by chance or by luck. Didn't you say that?
Well, not altogether, because I did do an awful lot of looking.
Well, you said that you were lucky in making these sightings. Is that correct?
Well, you can use the word lucky in that respect, because I happened to be wanting to see some, but I happened to be at the right place at the right time, so you could say that there was an amount of luck connected.
Well, now, here's the thing I wanted to ask you. Now, George Van Tassel, who you apparently know and are familiar with his operation, now, he doesn't need luck. Apparently, as I understand it, he has these seances, or whatever they might be called, and at the drop of a hat, any evening that he calls together one of these groups, he is able to talk to these people, which is quite a greater thing, let's say, than just seeing one of the craft. Now, I want to ask you, why is he on that plane, let's say, or has reached that state, whereas you're still just on chance or luck? What is the reason for this? How can you explain it?
Well, there are many different types of people. I might say this, that George Van Tassel is not exclusive in that field. There's a great deal of research being done by groups in attempting to, you might say, communicate without the use of instruments, and some of them are having considerable success. I do not know what information they're getting all the time, but I know that there is a great deal of experimenting being done on that. In fact, some of our universities are doing the same thing, so I do not consider that as fantastic as I did 3 years ago.
That doesn't answer the point here, though. How is it that some people only see flying saucers and then only by luck, whereas other people not only can see them but can talk to the occupants, and it isn't luck. It's planned, prearranged, they can do it at will. Now, what is the difference between these two types of people? Why are you in one of these categories, and a man like Van Tassel has gone so far into this, or is so privileged, or I don't know what his qualifications to the space visitors may be, but why is he so far advanced beyond the rest of us?
Well, in order to answer that, I'd have to go into quite a discussion. I'd just as soon go into it to a slight degree and say that there are different types of people. They have different talents and different interests.
Well, then, you feel that you don't have the same qualifications as Mr. Van Tassel? Does he know more about space, or does he have better qualifications than you?
Well, I would say that perhaps he has trained that special talent perhaps much more than I have. So,
do you
perhaps
feel,
I have the same thing, but haven't trained it so.
Then you could also reach the state then, perhaps? You could see saucers at will or talk to their occupants?
Well, I wouldn't go to that extent as to state that. Perhaps one could. I wouldn't go that far because I haven't experimented in that field, so I do not know exactly what the possibilities are, although I do recognize the fact that many people are developing in that line and seem to be getting some kind of contacts and information.
Art, would you answer me one thing? You said developing in that line. In what line, Art?
Well, he was mentioning Van Tassel's method of approach to this, of getting information direct. I have discussed this certain thing with Van Tassel quite frequently, and in fact, I have seen their method of handling it. And the surprising thing, perhaps, as far as I'm concerned, is that information given to him on by this method has been brought out in reports in our own astronomy at a later date, when it was specifically stated that this would occur at approximately this time. And one of them was a belt around the Earth, which is similar to what we observe on Saturn. Van Tassel published this in 52. And that there would be such a belt seen in our atmosphere in a short time, in a period of a couple years or so. We didn't say a definite time. And 2 years later, it was noted by our observers in astronomy that such a condition did exist or become visible. And there were other incidents of that type that seemed to show that the information that he was getting was holding true to a certain degree. And perhaps there were only a few of those incidents, and each one of them seemed to hold out. So, just go ahead, Jim.
Well, I just wanted to ask you this. Now, you gave one example there, but I've never seen any example of a definite scientific formula, let's say, given by the spacemen, something that you could approve all this by without any question of a doubt. Something that we won't come across for, let's say, 10 years or 20 years. Something, let's say, nothing useful that we could use against ourselves or against the spacemen, but something purely in theory, which they could give us and approve the whole thing for once and for all.
Well, I don't know if proving once and for all would be the proper thing.
Isn't it always proper to prove once and for all so that you remove all doubt? Wouldn't that be the proper thing to do?
Well, I do not look at it that way for several reasons. Basically this, that man is given free choice and free will, apparently, because we do exercise it, so apparently it is given. If we want to blow ourselves off the face of the earth, why, that apparently is our free choice to do so, and sometimes we go a long ways toward it. But nevertheless, if this was apparently taken away from us,
and others would come here and influence us in some way.
The ability to blow ourselves off the face of the earth was taken away from us?
No, I say that it has not been taken away from us. We do have free will and free choice. Let's take, for example, say certain communities in South America where they have not actually learned to even use a bow and arrow effectively. We over here could perhaps give those people a great deal of information if we so desired. And there's a lot of information that we perhaps could give them. But we're not going over there and changing their way of life. We're letting them pursue it as they see fit to pursue it. So couldn't we look at this picture in approximately the same manner and say that if these people are able to come here, that they are not coming here to change our way of life, but only to stir our curiosity to the point where we help ourselves. Because man is not an animal or anything like that. When you stir his curiosity, something happens. And when something happens in his line of thinking or his curiosity, he starts to put the thing together, and then he is helping himself perhaps much more than if somebody pushed it down his throat and made him believe it. When he learns it himself, he has learned it.
Getting down to basics. If you eat sparingly, you're apt to feel sort of light from not eating. But the thing that interests me most is the fact that, is there such a thing when flying a plane, and this is not a commercial, this is a question, is there such a thing when flying a plane that is the equivalent of driving a car, which is known as highway hypnosis? Is there such a thing as air fatigue from flying?
Yes, there is, but ordinarily you don't see things. That is, I haven't. I have flown almost across the nation without stopping, which takes, I have flown 12 to 14 hours, just stopping long enough to gas up and grab a sandwich and go on, and I didn't see anything during those trips.
Have you ever been airsick?
No, I never have, and I have spent several years at sea, and I haven't been seasick, so I have a strong constitution in that manner. It doesn't bother me.
Is it possible, Arthur, that while you were flying and you had this light meal, that due to the fact that you hadn't eaten possibly as much as you needed, that you were seeing spots before your eyes?
No, the only spots I see before my eyes are polka dots on dresses. I observe them, but that's the only spots I see before my eyes.
All right, now that brings me back to another important question. Have you ever seen these little items that they were selling for some time, that if you stared at it for a period of a minute and then looked up in the sky, it reflected the image or the picture of what you had seen?
Yes, I have seen those.
Were they red polka dots on the dress that you were watching?
Not necessarily, no.
Could it be that these dots that you were envisioning in the sky were nothing more than a transition or an image that you had imagined from these polka dots, since you're seeing these round balls, and you say that you love to follow polka dots?
Well, let's put it this way, Sergeant, that a polka dot does not expand and contract.
If your vision is impaired due to air waves, because of heat in the air, they might expand and contract, or else give the illusion that they're doing that.
Well, let's put it this way, Sergeant. I have seen many, many things that I could say, well, perhaps I saw something that might have been something like a flying saucer, but these things that I saw were so definitely something that there was no hallucination to it. There was nothing that it could be explained by, because I even took the precaution to look for reflections. I even opened the window from the airplane and looked without looking through anything, and first, because it was almost directly ahead of me in one case, I moved my position in relation to the windshield to see if the object would move, and in one case my wife was with me, and she observed it from the other side, or the other seat alongside of me, and she saw it in the same position and saw the same thing that I saw. And it was so dark that I couldn't have seen polka dots, because it was at night and the cockpit of the airplane is dark.
Arthur, I'd like to take you back to the earlier part when you were talking about California and these people that claimed they saw a flying saucer. These were friends of yours, you said. First, approximately what speed do these saucers fly?
all the way from zero to speeds that I do not know how fast.
Well, do they more or less travel as the crow flies?
Not necessarily, no.
Unless they have a scattered pattern. You said that these people hopped into their car and followed the saucer with their car.
Yes, and this certain one was meandering around. Apparently, I don't know why, but apparently it was just meandering around.
Well, meandering means they were going back and forth and around and no definite pattern.
Because there are several roads in that part of the country, and in order to follow it with a car, they had to take this road and that road, which would lead in the direction where
what
this
kind
ship
of a car do
going.
They have?
They have a Chev and a Nash. I do not know which one they had at that time.
Are any of the two cars a convertible?
No.
They're open cars or closed cars?
Closed cars.
What time of the year was this?
Well, now, it was in the fall, if I recall correctly.
And if they're following this saucer in their car, they'd probably have their head out the window?
Well, they didn't have to do anything of that.
The windows would be open so that they could see.
Yes.
The windows would be open. What I'm driving at is this. You made quite an emphasis on the fact that their hair was standing on end, and I'm trying to find out whether it was because of the so-called static electricity from the saucer or because the wind had ruffled it.
No, because the car was stopped at the time, and they were outside of the car and had approached toward the saucer perhaps 15 or 20 feet from the car when they claimed that their hair was more or less standing on end or felt as though it was, and it apparently was. You have perhaps seen some of these experiments in electronic fields. The same thing happens.
Sergeant Paley, some of the things that have occurred to you in reference to Mr. Ahill's sightings are volcanic heat waves, mirages, conventional heat waves, highway hypnosis, spots before eyes, kaleidoscopic spots, static electricity. The only thing that hasn't occurred to you, Sergeant, was that Mr. Ahill actually saw what he believed he saw, namely flying saucers.
Primarily because I really don't believe he saw it. Dominic.
Well, I'd like to say one thing here.
I believe you don't believe
Art. You said you saw three spherical objects. I was always under the impression that a flying saucer was a lenticular form.
Well, I have watched these, studied pictures of flying saucers quite often, and I find this to be very, very true, that when quite a bit of power, apparently, we must call it power, I guess, because it takes off, when a greater amount of power is applied, then this saucer or this object takes a round shape because it has apparently a field around it which emanates light. And so you are not observing the craft itself when there is any amount of power applied. But as the power diminishes, as is quite well shown in Cedric Ellingham's, for instance, as the power decreases and the saucer hovers close to the ground, then you see the shape of the ship. So it is not a definite form at any one time. But if you see one in very fast motion, you will see only a red ball.
Do you believe in Cedric Ellingham?
I have read his book, and I...
Did you ever meet him?
No.
He was out at the coast for a while. I think he returned to England. Am I correct?
I believe he did, but I did not have the opportunity to meet him. I just read his book. I was making comments on his pictures, which showed this certain type of emanation or light emanation from the ship at different conditions.
Well, let me take a moment to... talk about one of our sponsors.
John, I wanted to ask Art here about the light radiation coming from the saucer. Now, Arthur claims that this light emanates from all directions. Is this light an actual result of the drive, or does the light supply the drive energy, according to your opinion?
Well, I would say, because it's pretty hard to say definitely, but it would be in a form quite similar to a planet, the atmosphere of a planet, because when we take the experiments that have been done by taking a sphere and magnetizing it, we develop a field around a sphere, and if we observe a planet in the distance, we also observe a light which perhaps would be tied to a certain extent to the atmosphere, but it would be a result of the whole unit creating an electronic field, so to speak, around the ship, which would be visible in the form of light.
Mm-hmm. And before you stated that Van Tassel had a talent for contacting the people in the saucers. Were you implying in any manner, way or form, that Van Tassel has a talent for telepathy in any way or manner?
Well, let's look at the experiments done in the universities. I think that would prove that point out. In Duke University, they have experimented with telepathy for some time, and they find that some people are much better than others. So it would stand to reason that we would find the same condition in comparison with Van Tassel and others.
Does science as a unit accept Dr. Rhine's experiments as an accurate measure of telepathy? Do they accept telepathy, in other words?
Well, science, you'd have to go into people who are experimenting with it, and I would then state, I would quote a professor in Massachusetts Institute of Technology at a lecture. I'm sorry, I do not remember his name. They call him the father of electronics. He was at the University of California giving a lecture on mathematics, and he is also quite familiar with automation. And he stated that they had successfully measured the emanation from the brain of man in the process of thinking, and that this emanation did not apparently diminish with distance, as did, say, a radio or an instrument of that type. And that also, it could be stated that the brain, in respect to thinking, was also a receiving set. And also, this was stated some 22 years ago by the National Institute for Research into Mental and Nervous Disorders. They stated that beyond any doubt, the thinking part of brain took place outside of the brain, that the brain in that respect was a sending and receiving set.
Well, you made the statement there that the emanation, I asked the question, does science accept telepathy? And you answered by saying that science has discovered a radiation emanating from the human brain. I'd like the answer to the first question, please.
Well, by you would have to term science would be have to be science studying in that field, because a scientist studying something else would not necessarily go into that field. So I quoted science, which would be the universities that are doing research in this, and also the National Institute that was doing research in this field specifically.
Would you say, Dr. Rhine, during the term of his experiments, which has encompassed a great many years of research, a lot of hard work on Dr. Rhine's part, and you made the statement that at times he has had people there who definitely had telepathic powers, how is it that Dr. Rhine does not talk to spacemen?
Well, perhaps they haven't tried very hard. I don't know. You'd have to ask Dr. Rhine. Maybe he has. This happened in with Dr. Smith in Canada. He was the man who was in charge of Project Magnet, they called it in Canada. And I heard a tape made by him where he claimed to have developed this, and he had information which is being used today in experimental work in a new type of aerial and so on.
That wasn't the cardinal dipsoid loop, was it?
Not necessarily, no.
No, well, that's a big difference, you know. There might be such a ESP, but now talking to spacemen is an entirely different field and an entirely different subject. I think that should definitely be made clear here.
Yes, I would say that they are two different subjects, but they're, again, associated in a manner that if the possibility of the brain can be demonstrated to have that quality of sending and receiving, then it would be possible, perhaps, with instruments to activate that further. Say, for instance, that people riding around in flying saucers had equipment developed to sensitize this certain condition further.
Mr. Rahal, you've known George Van Tassel for a period of time. Have you ever attended any of his seances? And I know that he doesn't like that term to be used, but I don't know of any other term to use.
Yes, I attended two.
You're talking about in the...
Two of them.
I wonder if you could describe for the gentleman sitting around the table and for our listeners what takes place when he receives these alleged telepathic communications from the Martians or Venusians or from the planet Clarion, wherever it may come. Could you describe this for us, please?
Well, yes, I could. Van Tassel has described it himself, so I feel that it's all right to describe it also.
I don't want his description, though, Mr. Aho. I want your description as a viewer. In other words, there's a certain number of people sitting down in this cave, and how about the lights? And just what happens as you see it?
Yes. Well, ordinarily, the lights are dim. And, well, I don't know. I really don't like to describe this too much because, after all, it takes quite a while to even get a basic understanding, perhaps, of what would happen.
Well, I am a non-believer in this, Arthur, but nevertheless, something happened there. Whether this was done by trickery or whether this was... psychic phenomena or whatever it was, something happened. In other words, let me explain it to you this way, Arthur. If I have a deck of cards here and I ask you to think of a card and I snap my finger and you cut the deck and the card that you were thinking of is on the top of the deck, this is very interesting. How did I do it? Am I a card manipulator? Am I a magician? Or was this magic, legitimate magic? Now, I'm not asking you to tell me what you think happened. I would like you to describe to the gentleman sitting around this table and to our listeners what you saw. I'm not going to ask you to go on the limb and say to me, John, this is true telepathic communication. I don't want you to also say, John, I don't believe this happened. You saw something. Even if the man went into a stupor or into a trance or whatever it may be. Something happened. He did something.
Yes.
Can you describe that, please?
Well, really, I'll say it was quite simple. But being as the subject could get very involved, I do not believe I care to discuss what I saw. I'll just leave it at that point and let others experiment with it. And in time, perhaps, more will be known about this.
May I merely make this brief comment, sir? And maybe you'll feel that it's being too critical to a guest, but nevertheless, it is my comment. I feel that you're being extremely unfair, Arthur, to Venusians, Martians, our listeners, and to the gentleman sitting around in this respect only, sir. If you believe in this, I don't. But if you do, and if you feel that some people, not including yourself, have been contacted by Venusians or Martians through a telepathic communication, it would seem to me that you would be willing to describe what you saw. I'm not asking you to give it the stamp, the seal of an approval of Arthur Ahol. The reason that this should be described is so that other people can attempt to go through the same motions, and possibly, if you are a sincere believer in this, possibly these people may be fortunate enough to be able to be contacted. If I may just briefly give you this analogy. If I have
a box with a dial on it and a switch. And you tell me that this is some instrument that I can hear music on. But you don't tell me what to do with it. I may fool around with this for years and never know how to get the music on it. But if you're kind enough to say, John, I don't know if this thing actually works, but you should push the switch up so it's facing the ceiling, and you should turn the dial so that it's on number 21, and there's a rubber cord hanging out of the side, and inside that rubber looks like a thin piece of rubber hose. There are two copper wires, and there's a plug on it. You will find in some homes a receptacle to plug this in. If you do all of those three things, maybe something will happen. I may have ability, I may own this instrument for years, but I never know how to use it. It may be a latent talent that is not developed. That's why I think it's... However, I'm certainly not going to force the issue. You'd rather me drop it?
Well,
forget it completely.
I'll put it this way, John. That, basically, I do not want to be responsible for what might happen to people experimenting in this field.
Something
I have seen
detrimental
people,
happen to them?
I have seen people experimenting with this and not understanding what they were experimenting with, got themselves into trouble. And I do not want to be responsible for giving any information that might...
You don't want to even tell us what, and we don't want any names mentioned. You don't want to even tell us what type of trouble they got into?
Well,
were they ill mentally, physically? Did they become ill after this? Or do you mean trouble with local authorities or just trouble with people in the community who start to point a finger at and say there's something wrong with Joe?
No, there are really many types of things that can happen, but it's trouble to the individual, I would put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
That if this is not understood very well and experimented with very cautiously, and also perhaps the imagination of the individual entering can become unbalanced and placed in institutions for a period.
Then it is quite permanent.
Yes, unless it is very well understood. I would not advise it was studied very thoroughly before.
Okay, I have another question. Well, I would like to conduct, I don't want to take a chance and jeopardize by doing this. Where would study this? I don't imagine there's a school. What books would you suggest that I should read first in order to acclimate myself to conducting these experiments?
Well, I had a number of books that give up to do, but there, as far as I know, there is pattern. Because many ways, if there are groups that conduct these experiments, so I feel that it would be that you have any definite book that would give you all...
A moment ago that there would be something that they might reach the point that they go insane. Did you actually...
Was that there are so many subtle forces that can be contacted. Notice the papers here recently of a phenomena going around that our scientists and people, eminent people in their fields, are trying to find out what it is. We've observed it, things flying around the room and so on. There are subtle forces surrounding us. We have a natural barrier in our intellect. That is why the sergeant here questions me so thoroughly, because his intellect is actually guarding his own inner feelings. You might say his subconscious, which he's called. It can be called by any name. But this intellect is a guardian of the individual. And in doing these experiments, you take this intellect out of the way and open the door for things to flow in. And if you do not know what is coming in, it's exactly the same as if you lived on a busy street and you opened your door and anybody could wander in. If you left it open, it might be a tramp and it might be a pretty good Joe.
But well, it sounds like evil entities of some sort. But let me ask you this. How does Van Tassel do this and not go insane? Or could I suggest that perhaps this is some sort of a mental aberration on his part after all?
Well, let us say that Van Tassel experimented in the field for some time and let us say that he develops something. That's all that the opinion that I would have of it myself. And that is how he states it, that it took him several years of diligent experimenting and pursuing to develop this certain method that he uses. So...
Dominic.
Mr. Aho, for many years, have you ever heard of the Masters of the Far East?
Yes, I've heard of them.
You realize, of course, that these supposed adepts are extremely integrated beings, and that these adepts give freely of this information in order to arrive at the various mental stages required to induce what we may term supernormal phenomena. Now, if Van Tassel has these powers, and I've done a little studying into the occult, and it certainly seems that you are going into the occult. Now, actually, I don't particularly see the relationship between the occult and what would be, to me anyway, a super scientific civilization of beings who are more or less observing us, as you state. And certainly it is my opinion and my knowledge from what I have read, that these masters of the who attain this terrific power of mind over matter, of mind over space and time, they give freely of this information. They certainly don't hide it. And I don't think that, if you want my honest opinion, I personally don't think that Van Tassel has any powers. Because if he had, he would also have the knowledge to go with it. And if he had the knowledge to go with it, he would give this information freely to everyone.
Well, I would like to clarify one point there, that in contacting, well, you put it in the contacting space people or the occult, that a person searching, trying to contact, say, space people on a craft, not knowing how to go about it, could contact something of a very low nature also. If they, that would clarify the point of why.
Well, first you'd have to objectify something of a low nature.
Well, that's very true, but if someone not qualified to, not experienced in this or with a proper background, would not know what they were contacting.
What is the proper background, Art?
That I will not take. I will not take the responsibility of putting out because there are books available on the subject. If people want to experiment with this, that's their business. But I am not going to be guilty of putting out information and stirring curiosity for practicing in this field by what I might state over the air. If people want to research into it and get books, that's their business.
Do you know of the name of any book?
I have not read other than glanced at them myself. I have not followed this line of research, so I'm not qualified to.
Do you feel that George Van Tassel read many of these books prior to starting in this avenue of research?
According to his story, no. He claims that he came by quite accidentally. He intermingled with people who were doing research in this, and it came about quite accidentally to him, is his story on that. He stated that at some of his lectures, so we assume that that is so.
This is WOR Radio, your station in New York, and this is Long John with the Party Line. We're around from midnight to 5:30, 6 mornings during the week. Well, Mr. Aho, I think that we just go around in a circle about this telepathic communication because you seem reluctant. I frankly didn't consider you to be an expert in the field, and I wasn't even going to ask you to guide us as far as the experiments are concerned, but at this point I realize that evidently you have a greater knowledge of it than I even presumed, for the simple reason that you are telling us about some of the tremendous pitfalls that it could affect a person mentally unless they are, let us say, trained or have a latent ability that must be developed gradually. However, so we'll get away from that a moment unless, as time goes on, that you feel that you should divulge some of this knowledge. I would like to ask you this, sir. You're acquainted with the Howard Menger story about the young man in High Bridge, New Jersey? You met
yes.
Howard, I think. I know you did, out of the last convention. I was wondering if you could give our listeners your honest opinion about Howard Menger. We all know that he's a very nice gentleman, has a very lovely family out in High Bridge, New Jersey. And so when I ask you about an opinion about Howard Menger, I mean about his alleged contact with space people. Would you give us your opinion on that as a, as an expert, as a gentleman who is a researcher in this field?
Yes, I feel that I can give an opinion on that. I know Howard quite well. In fact, I was with him the time he made his first appearance on this show. Van Tassel and I were with him.
I forgot that that was
so, in fact, we were the people who dug him out for his first appearance.
Yes, sir, you certainly were, and I'm very, very grateful.
We did make a trip out there at that time and meet quite a few of the neighbors and heard their stories and heard the stories of the relatives. And we visited the spot where he had had claimed most of his experiences. And the stories that he told and the pictures that he showed us, I felt for sure that he had definitely had experiences. And I still feel the same way.
You like the pictures?
Yes, I do. There are some pictures that show emanations of energy that look very realistic to me. I've observed fields of energy, and they look very good to me.
I'm certainly not trying to embarrass you as a guest, Mr. Aho, but may I ask you this? Do you feel that you're qualified to determine whether or not pictures are fakes or whether they are authentic?
Well, pictures, especially of saucers, are rather confusing because you do not see the distinct saucer itself in the first place. In most cases, you see a fuzzy appearance around the saucer, and in what I have experienced in the research end of it, that is necessary. Otherwise, they wouldn't be propelled by the method that they are. But in Howard's experiences, and the way he talks of them, they compare very well with other people that have had experiences. And we sponsored him on the coast. He made a trip back there before the convention.
Mm-hmm.
And he told his story, and he always told it the same way, which I feel goes for authenticity. If the story continually changes, then perhaps one can say it doesn't.
Of course, there can be two ways you can look at it. You can be complimentary and say the gentleman is a talented actor, or you can say he's a gentleman that has had a true experience. I might also add one more point to this statement that you just made, Mr. Aho. You mentioned that his story is similar to the story that we've heard from other people who have claimed physical contact.